Shalom and welcome to Israel Policy Pod. I'm your host, Shani Reichman, joined by Neri Zilber, a journalist based in Tel Aviv and a policy advisor with Israel Policy Forum. Chanukah Sameach, Neri.
Chag Sameach, Shani. It's good to be back with you after a short hiatus, at least on your end. I hope you enjoyed it.
I did. I had a lot of FOMO, honestly, listening to the podcast without being on it, but I did really enjoy Michael and Shira had to say.
Yeah, it was nice to have them back, and also nice for me to have you back this week.
Thank you. So we have a lot to talk about today. There are 105 soldiers at this point who have died in battle. We're 2.5 months into the war. About 18,000 Palestinians killed, according to the Hamas numbers, but the IDF numbers include about 6,000 of them being counted as militants. And of course, there continue to be about 136 hostages held in Hamas captivity. Unfortunately, not all of them are alive anymore or believed to be alive. But there are some hopeful reports of moving towards another hostage deal, potentially, although they seem to just be kind of light reports at the moment. Maybe you can talk a bit about that, too. We know the Kerem Shalom crossing between Gaza and Israel has opened up for aid, which does take a lot of pressure off of the Rafah crossing in Egypt. I know Shira spoke last week a bit about the aid situation that, and how that contributes to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. And of course, the way in which that allows the IDF to keep their operations going over a longer period of time. Now, last time we spoke, it sounded like we were many, many, many months away from this war ending. Right. And Shira last week, without me there, but, only a little bitter. Shira on last week's pod spoke about, the many challenges for Israeli society, never mind Gazan society, with the war continuing deep into 2024, as expected. Right. Economic burden, the universities, et cetera. Never mind the obvious issues with fighting a war for so long. Now, I want you to talk to us a little bit about, how much progress has been made just in the last week, specifically with regards to the tunnels being flooded with seawater, which is, a pretty controversial approach for a lot of reasons. It's not without its risks. But you also mentioned that the tunnels are really at the core of what the IDF is trying to target. So does this really change the nature of how long the war is going to take, given the potential to expedite the process? And we're also hearing a lot of reports of mass surrendering from Hamas fighters, including those now infamous photos of the men in their underwear sitting in the street giving up their weapons. We also hear testimonials, anonymous ones usually, of Gazans being very fed up with Hamas and blaming them, rightfully, of course, for this war, and the Hamas organization starting to fracture. I'll add that that was one of the questions someone sent us on Instagram. Don't forget to send us your questions on Instagram if you have them, on Israel Policy Forum's account. So what's your read on the progress made? Are there any new insights on the timeline that you can update, given, some of the differences since we last spoke? And do you think it's accurate to say that Hamas is starting to give up? And where does our least favorite man, Yahya Sinwar, fit into this equation?
Okay, all very well taken questions. So I'll take it step by step. Number one, in terms of the actual figures, so it's now officially 113 IDF casualties throughout the course of the war, but really since the ground operation into the Gaza Strip was launched October 27th. And just over the past 24 hours, 10 IDF soldiers and officers were killed, mostly in one incident in northern Gaza in the Sajaiya neighborhood east of Gaza City. A very deadly and tragic incident. Lieutenant Colonel, about battalion commander in the Golani Brigade, was killed. A colonel in one of the command posts also killed. Don't need to get into the details, but a very somber morning for Israel waking up to those news. And all told, 10 IDF casualties over the past day. And so it brings the total up to 113, like I said. And according to IDF estimates on the other side of the ledger, it's an estimate, as we've talked about in previous weeks, but maybe around 7,000 Hamas and other militants and terrorists killed so far during the war. So the numbers keep ticking up on both sides, because obviously the war is very much still going on. And to your second question, the war will still keep going on. So the notion that you hear, some reports also coming out of Washington, obviously, really over the past day, given President Biden's remarks, when people talk about the war ending or the U.S. pressuring Israel to end the war, that's not how this is going to play out. The war will not end, as we talked about previously, and as I reported previously in the Financial Times. The war will continue for most of the coming year, likely, or at least into late 2024, at a lower intensity. That's essentially the Israeli war plan, the Israeli strategy, by necessity and also by design. And so when you talk about, okay, will Israel end the war? Will the U.S. stop Israel from prosecuting the war? It's really just shifting from this kind of high-intensity ground operation phase to the third stage, which would be lower intensity. You pull out the heavy divisions that are currently in definitely North Gaza and now in Southern Gaza targeting the city of Khan Yunis, and you kind of work with smaller forces, brigade-sized forces, standoff fire, like airstrikes, drones, artillery, and the like, and you go in and conduct raids if and when Hamas raises its head out of those very infamous tunnels. So the war is not going to end. It's just a question of whether Biden primarily will demand Israel to shift into the lower intensity phase. So we should all be very clear-eyed about what may happen and what will definitely not happen in the coming months. What will dictate that? A lot of things, the humanitarian situation inside Gaza and primarily southern Gaza, very dire, as we know, and as Shira pointed out last week. But really, for Israel to achieve most, if not all, of its war aims, it needs to find a solution for those tunnels. 500 kilometers of tunnels underneath the Gaza Strip, which is not a very big area, as a colleague of mine looked into and reported, bigger than the London Underground, this tunnel network, and really underground cities under the Gaza Strip, which provides our least favorite person.
That's what we're calling him now, our least favorite person.
He's definitely our least favorite person, but he deserves some of our grudging respect, let's put it that way. And that's not since October 7th, I'd argue, since before October 7th, but that's a whole other conversation, as somebody who's closely tracked Sinwar for a number of years now. And so one of the solutions to cracking those tunnels is flooding it with seawater from the Mediterranean. There are other techniques that Israel has been using and may use in future, but it really depends on whether you can kind of introduce that on a mass scale into the Gaza Strip and to have it be effective, because without the tunnels, the fighters, the leadership, you know, rocket production sites, weapons, everything will either be completely submerged or they'll need to pop out. And above ground is a very different story for Hamas. So that's just in terms of the tunnels, and we have to see. Israel is very tight-lipped about this issue. There is a military censor that reviews a lot of the reporting, definitely from the Israeli press. So much of the confirmed reporting comes out of Washington, out of U.S. officials. And so we saw our friends in the Wall Street Journal report, I think yesterday, that Israel had started flooding the tunnels. They had been doing that before, just based on my own information. So question whether you can kind of introduce that on an industrial scale, again, not only in northern Gaza, but also in southern Gaza. I think that'll be a bit more challenging just operationally. But then you run into the question, what happens to the Israeli hostages likely being held in those tunnels? And the hostage families themselves have come out very strongly and said, you can't flood the tunnels if our loved ones are down there. So a very, very difficult moral quandary, a very, very difficult military quandary. There are no easy answers. And so you have to be very, very careful and have very precise intelligence to make sure that you're not flooding places that may hold hostages. The other question, is Hamas on the verge of collapse? Again, we've seen reports of that effect. We saw those infamous pictures, which the IDF belatedly but very clearly stated did not come from them. So it came from other sources on the ground, maybe soldiers, maybe other bodies on the ground. The short answer is no. Hamas is not on the verge of collapse. It is true, I'd argue, that Hamas in the northern Gaza Strip has been heavily, heavily damaged. And so there are still pockets, whether in Sajaiya, like we saw tragically last night, or Jabalia, that there's still holdouts and still very fierce fighting. Oftentimes, if you look at the videos, kind of not even street by street, but room to room fighting, just based on the videos that are released officially by the IDF. So northern Gaza and the two Hamas brigades in that area are likely on the verge of collapse. But again, you know, I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow, but the IDF is making very good progress. The problem is that there are three brigades of Hamas and the leadership, and still rockets like we've seen even this afternoon and yesterday over Tel Aviv that are still capable of being fired into Israel. So you still have the whole issue of southern Gaza, and the Khan Yunis, the southern push by the IDF, only really began about a week and a half ago. So basically, to bring it all back, it's a race against the clock for Israel. It'll still require a number of weeks, I'd argue, to really make a dent in southern Gaza with the focus on Khan Yunis, to get anywhere near, I don't want to say collapse, but you know, degrading Hamas's military capabilities, maybe getting some senior leaders, maybe even potentially, hopefully, rescuing some hostages. But we're not there yet. And so the question is whether Israel and the IDF have enough time on the international diplomatic clock. And that's where the U.S. administration and Biden himself come into the picture. We know, again, even according to Israeli planning, that it'll run into January. But are we talking New Year's Day, January 1st? Are we talking mid-January? Are we talking late January, when Washington maybe will put its foot down? And what will the reality on the ground look like? Will the IDF have made enough progress come January, into January? That's really the question, the key question right now.
Just to hang on to this thread about the role that the U.S. is playing in all of this, and I don't want to get too in the weeds, but something that has changed since we last spoke is that we heard Joe Biden refer to indiscriminate bombing to describe what Israel is doing in Gaza. Now, I think you and I would both not feel at all comfortable with that description, but it seems at the very least he clearly thinks the IDF has the ability to complete their operation with less force, fewer aerial strikes, and ultimately fewer casualties on the Palestinian side. So first of all, is that accurate in your view, right? And I do want to say there's obviously a difference between indiscriminate and excessive. Indiscriminate, in my mind, is not up for debate. It's clearly not the case. But excessive use of force is kind of vague, hard to determine unless you're really in the military. So in your conversations with folks in the field, what's your sense of the degree to which the bombing is either indiscriminate or excessive? I think we should talk more about excessive. And I will say, I think, you know, Biden does have a tendency to speak off the cuff. So I wouldn't assume that this is his official position, is that it's indiscriminate, right? I think it's very possible he more meant something like excessive. And I just think that needs to be said. But I want to hear more from you on this.
So it's a great question. I'm not going to get into the head of the U.S. president, who I love and respect very much. But he's, especially these days, you know, getting up there in age. I don't think I'm making any news or saying something out of school here. And so it is an open question what he actually meant when he's up there on stage giving, like you said, and even his aide said after the fact, off-the-cuff remarks. So I don't know what he meant. I'll tell you the official IDF line, and then I'll tell you the unofficial IDF line, and then I'll tell you what I think the reality is on the ground, if that's okay. The official IDF line is that airstrikes or any other kinetic action, as it's called, inside the Gaza Strip is based on intelligence and threat assessments on the ground, and that the use of force is very heavily calibrated, very heavily monitored. That's the official IDF line. The unofficial IDF line is that, especially in this campaign, the rules of engagement, as they have come to be known in previous, definitely Gaza conflicts, have been loosened. And that's, again, I don't think I'm breaking any news here. I don't think it's a state secret, but there are looser rules of engagement. Now, to my mind, the reality on the ground is probably a mix of both, that you're dealing with a heavily fortified urban environment set up over the course of 16 years, as we've talked about in previous episodes, that the IDF has now sent not three, but four divisions to go and dismantle. And so, like we saw even last night in Sajia, this was booby-trapped houses, ambushes with RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, and sniper rifles, and live fire from very close quarters. And so to protect their own soldiers, the IDF oftentimes feels the need to use the tools and the advantages at its disposal to eliminate those threats. And so, again, I'm not in the targeting room for the Israeli Air Force. I'm not on the ground in the alleyways and streets of Sajaiya or Khan Yunis. So I can't speak from a position of authority, but that's my sense in terms of the reality on the ground. And yes, the Americans from the very beginning, we need only think back to what Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, said, I think, that first week or maybe even the second week when he came to visit, were fully supportive of Israel's war aims, you know, dismantling Hamas as a military and governing force in the Gaza Strip. What happened on October 7th was beyond the pale in its savagery, in its brutality. We've talked about it before. We don't need to get into the gruesome details. And we'll back Israel to the hilt, militarily, diplomatically, weapons shipments, and the like. But it does matter how Israel goes about this war. It does matter how it prosecutes this campaign. And that's been a consistent U.S. message, that Israel, to the extent possible, needs to limit uninvolved and civilian casualties on the Palestinian side, it needs to facilitate more humanitarian aid to avoid a humanitarian disaster in the Gaza Strip. And so that's been a consistent message from the Americans. And I'd argue it's a correct message. And again, you know, whether Israel has fully taken it to heart, I think it has taken a lot of it to heart, definitely within the, you know, in terms of the humanitarian aid and doing a lot more than it did in the very beginning of the war, right? When certain Israeli government ministers said, you know, not a glass of water would go in, full siege until our hostages are released. Obviously, that has changed dramatically, that policy, definitely over the past month and a half. So again, you know, the U.S. is very involved in this war, in this campaign, but Israel, whether the government or the IDF, are the ones actually conducting it. And, you know, it's Israelis on the front line, after all.
Let's move to what we've been calling the day after in Gaza, even though we both know there won't be a very clear, you know, day that everything ends. Our listeners should know already, but we released a report called Starting from the Ground Up, U.S. Policy Options for Post-Hamas Gaza. That is what was discussed in the last podcast, but it was not yet released. So there is going to be a link in the description, or by the time you listen to this, there's already a link in the description if you want to take a look at it. We also have, you know, an executive summary, so you don't have to read the whole thing. In any case, we don't need to rehash the very mixed messages from the Israeli government about what they do or don't want to see for the day after in Gaza, because we already discussed this at length, right? But since the last recording, Netanyahu suggested that the Gulf countries will get involved, specifically the Saudis, the Emiratis, and how they are going to help rehabilitate Gaza after the war, maybe even oversee some of the Gaza Strip, right? And of course, this is amidst concern from his own government partners upon hearing the U.S. and other countries insisting the Palestinian Authority should be part of the rebuilding, right? And that a future Palestinian state must be kept on the table, which is at odds with the entire worldview of the current Israeli government. But then we heard this week, the Emiratis reported as saying their rehabilitation of the Gaza Strip is contingent upon a two-state solution plan. And that they will help in the interim, but they're not governing the Gaza Strip. It needs to be based on an idea of two states. So what's your read on how the Emiratis and maybe the Saudis are approaching this moment? Do they mean what they say? Will they actually not get involved unless they have that commitment? And is Netanyahu going to be capable of getting his government on board with such a plan that releases Israel from the responsibility of the Gaza Strip, but requires a two-state horizon? Obviously, it's very beneficial for everybody. But he is a government that it's very hard to imagine getting on board with such a thing. And of course, all of this assumes his government is in power in the day after in Gaza, which is up for discussion as well.
Yeah. The answers to all those questions is no. That's the long and the short of it.
Oh, good. Let's move on to the next question.
Done. You know, in life, Shani, I want a lot of things. You know, I want a day off. I want $1 million. I want to, you know, a beach vacation somewhere where I don't have to think about Hamas tunnels and Yahya Sinwar. But that's just not going to happen, at least anytime soon. And so we have to face the world as it is and to face the reality of the situation mm-hmm. right now in Gaza, which is something that Netanyahu and his government very much are not doing, especially when it comes to these conversations and debates about the day after, quote unquote, for Gaza. So Netanyahu himself says, well, there won't be Hamas and there won't be international peacekeepers and there won't be an IDF reoccupation and there definitely won't be the Palestinian Authority. So what are you left with, right? This is in terms of just pure policy, it's pie in the sky. And we all know why he's saying and doing these things. It's pure domestic politics. He's trying to keep his far-right coalition allies on side, so to speak. And so he doesn't want to alienate them because he himself thinks there is a day after for him politically here in Israel, if and whenever this war ends or if and whenever a new election takes place. We shouldn't kind of beat around the bush. This is purely why he's doing this. He's smart enough, as he reminds us constantly, to understand that this is all, like I said, pie in the sky. There's no, I've heard this from Israeli officials, the notion that Arab countries, whether the Emiratis, the Saudis, Egyptians, Jordanians, whoever, will come and just rebuild Gaza, the ruins of Gaza, really, literally, for essentially for free in terms of, you know, the demands of Israel, is not going to happen. It's not going to happen. It would be nice, especially if you're an Israeli hardliner, to think that'll happen, but it won't. And so what the U.S., again, from very early on in this war, has been trying to do, very talented American diplomats have been crisscrossing the Middle East, trying to kind of square the circle of, okay, what happens a day after in Gaza, you know, contingent on Hamas not being there or being severely, severely weakened. And all the Arab capitals are coming back and saying, look, you have to present a more positive vision for what we can call the Israeli-Palestinian conflict writ large. And so it would entail, you know, two-state solution or whatever you want to call it, but you need to present a more positive vision that I think by necessity would entail a major role for the Palestinian Authority. You know, reunifying Gaza and the West Bank, trying to bolster and reform the Palestinian Authority itself. So having kind of a Palestinian Authority on the ground management component. By the way, Shira got into this better than I could last week. But you have to have a very strong kind of Palestinian Authority component wrapped in a Arab regional umbrella, right? Not just money, but other things as well, with international buy-in and support. And by the way, Israeli coordination and buy-in and support. That's kind of the best case scenario for the day after in Gaza. And this current Israeli government led by Netanyahu is just refusing to countenance that kind of setup. And I've heard this firsthand from various officials, both here and in other places, that when this question of the day after comes up, they just don't want to engage on it or engage on it in a realistic way. They think they can finish this war whenever, at some point next year, and there will be some local actors in Gaza that they can back and, I suppose, arm and fund that will magically run and rebuild Gaza for Israel. And that's, again, it's pie in the sky from my point of view. And it's causing a lot of damage, I'd argue, because it's not just what happens the day after in Gaza, right, when the war ends, if it ends in some variation, but it also impacts what's happening right now. And also the Arab regional mood, international support, and so on and so forth. So it has real tangible impact right now. And it's wholly damaging to the war effort.
Are you somewhat optimistic that the Gulf states are going to be willing to keep that pressure on, to sort of leverage their, frankly, their funding to kind of push Israel to agree to their demands, or is that just off out of the question because they're also desperate to, you know, lower the temperature?
I don't think so. I mean, look, they're already doing some things, right? I was told that 95% of the aid that's now actively being moved into the Gaza Strip, 95% is Arab from the Middle East, 5% from Western donors. There's a Jordanian and Emirati field hospitals, plural, in southern Gaza. So they are doing, you know, to the extent possible, you know, a decent amount, I would say, right now. But again, why would anybody want to take the problem of Gaza off of Israel's hands, especially if there are still IDF forces on the ground conducting, you know, lower intensity combat against the remnants of Hamas and the other militant groups? And so I think both regional and at some point, I assume, American and international pressure will come to bear on this government in Israel or any other government in Israel and say, look, what was the Powell doctrine back in the day? You broke it, you fix it. That's Colin Powell for our younger listeners. just FYI, I know we made a reference, or I made a reference to Donald Rumsfeld way back when, a number of weeks ago. And so I should also clarify who Colin Powell is or was. Rest in peace. So no, I don't see it. And again, we're all talking about kind of, these are best case scenarios. What if there's an ongoing insurgency inside Gaza with the remnants? You know, you only need a 500 or 1,000 guys with Kalashnikovs to make the situation there very difficult for anybody who goes in, including the IDF, who may remain there. That's even before we start talking about the West Bank, that is also anything but stable at the moment, including the position of the Palestinian Authority, politically, financially, in terms of basic security inside the Palestinian cities of the West Bank. That's even before we talk about the northern border, Israel-Hezbollah tensions and the like. So, you know, I understand people's, how shall I put it, sentiment or tiredness. I think we're all tired. And this war has gone on now for over 2 months. But it could last in some variation for a lot longer than this. And it could spread much farther than the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, well, I guess we'll have to wait and see, unfortunately. Hopefully we won't have to wait too long.
Okay, we'll be right back after this brief message.
2 months since the horrific Hamas terrorist attacks on October 7th, the immense challenges ahead are still coming into focus. Our policy, community, and next generation leaders are on the front lines in an increasingly hostile, complex, and polarized moment. They need our support, and we need yours. Our policy analysts are providing nuanced insight, commentary, and information to help policymakers, community leaders, and others understand and navigate the challenges of this ongoing crisis. Our community engagement is in overdrive, with constant educational programming for communities and organizations across North America, and an acceleration of our IPF Fatigue programming for young professionals and students on college campuses. Our social media posts are reaching tens of thousands of viewers, with nuanced analysis and insights as an essential alternative to slogans and misinformation. We need your support to sustain this work. Please consider making a gift today to ensure that we can continue to be a source of credible analysis and constructive ideas. Donate now at ipf.li/supportthepod or at the Support the Show link in the show notes.
We have a lot of folks asking in our Instagram, and this is just a friendly reminder to follow Israel Policy Forum on Instagram and send us direct messages. We will also put, you'll see our stories. We ask specifically for you to insert questions for the podcast once a week, but you can also send messages at any point and just flag them that they are for the podcast. In any case, many folks are asking about the future of Israeli politics. So we see the protests against Netanyahu starting up again, amidst massive calls for his resignation. Many folks are also talking about where Benny Gantz is in this moment, since he's, of course, part of the emergency cabinet, but also clearly going to be Netanyahu's main opponent in the next election.
The eternal question.
And you can share a little bit.
Where is Benny Gantz?
And you can also, Yes, all the time. You can also share a bit about the polling, which, you know, puts him quite ahead of the Likud party. That assumes, you know, that Netanyahu is actually going to run in the next election, of course. And meanwhile, we have Yair Lapid and Yair Golan, who are two of the other names floated around to lead parties. One already leads a party, right? And I will add, Yair Golan was one of the heroes of October 7th, which gives him a leg up from where he was before that. So where's Israeli politics headed? I know that's your favorite question to receive. I'll also add, there's this feeling that division caused the war in some ways. And so Israelis have to be unified at all times. But at the same time, Israelis see the politicians, especially those in office right now, politicking as usual, as we've said many, many times. And so why should they stay out? Why should they not go back to fighting for their values and their agenda when the government is already doing that?
Yeah, there was a brief moment after October 7th where you would call up certain people in the political sphere and they say, well, you know, now is not the time for politics. that period was very short-lived, and politics have come back in a big way in Israel, even during this war, even during this period of, you know, correct and rightful national unity pretty much across the board. And there is a lot of politicking going on, especially from the very top, from the prime minister's office. And it's, I'm going to choose my words carefully. It's unfortunate. Let's put it that way. It's unfortunate that the prime minister who's running this war, who should have better things to occupy his time, much more important things, we should say, to occupy his time, is focusing on how he's going to get out of this latest jam politically. And as we know, Bibi is a master politician, but this is a jam unlike any other. But it doesn't mean he's not going to try. And we've already seen in recent days, he's trying to relitigate a peace deal that was signed 30 years ago, the Oslo Accords. And I tweeted out yesterday in a moment of anger that Netanyahu is ending his political career like he started it 30 years ago, campaigning against the Oslo Accords. And so there's a nice symmetry to it, but it's it would be funny if it wasn't so stupid that this is the campaign that he thinks is gonna keep him in the prime minister's office. So that's just Netanyahu.
Just another moment on that. How do you think Israelis are responding? Are they kind of buying that perspective that somehow, I mean, I can understand drawing the line between Oslo and this moment, but you can also draw the line between this moment and 1,000 other things, most of them that were done by Netanyahu in the last 10 years. So does that land with the Israeli public, do you think? Does it even land with his base?
Look, with his base, or at least a portion of his base, maybe. Maybe. We've seen them stay with him through thick and thin, but even according to every poll, and even you talk to Likudniks and Israeli right-wingers, even they are no longer on the Bibi train. And, you know, will it land? I want to say probably not. Again, it remains to be tested. And it's a bit ridiculous that the prime minister, who's been essentially in charge here for the past, 15 years, and going back to the 1990s, what, another 3 years? So almost two decades out of the 30 that he's now referencing. He had ample opportunity to do something different than the Oslo Accords. And we have to remember back in the 90s, Bibi did cut deals with Yasser Arafat, continued the Oslo Accords, again, probably not to the extent that anybody wanted him to, and begrudgingly, but he did. He took power in 2009, so the division between the West Bank and Gaza and the loss of control by the Palestinian Authority of Gaza to Hamas was already a fait accompli, but he had ample opportunities and ample rounds and conflicts with Hamas to end Hamas rule in the Gaza Strip. He didn't, very purposefully and intentionally did not. He thought it would be very useful to play divide and rule, to essentially bolster Hamas, bolster the division inside the Palestinian body politique, and to weaken the Palestinian Authority, so there wouldn't be any calls to renew genuine peace talks, essentially giving money and other concessions to the guys in Gaza firing rockets at you every few months or every few years in these rounds of conflict, and actively weakening the guys in the West Bank, who are still, to this day, actively coordinating with you on security. That was a deliberate strategy by Bibi Netanyahu over the course of more than a decade. And so that has very little to do with the Oslo Accords. This has everything to do with Netanyahu and his decisions. And it blew up in everyone's faces, including his, on October 7th in the worst way possible, as we've said ad nauseum on this podcast since October 7th. So, that's just in terms of Netanyahu's play. Now, big picture in terms of the political arena here, one thing is for certain, the battle lines politically inside Israel will be very different if and when an election arrives than they are now. So you mentioned Benny Gantz, who is flying very high in the polls. And, there are legitimate reasons for that in terms of his increasing support amongst the public. But what is less understood outside of Israel is that Benny Gantz now has half a party, that his running mate from the right, Gideon Saar, former senior Likud official and education minister and the like, he broke with Netanyahu very publicly a few years ago. Who can remember before which election it was, but it did happen before one of the elections, and eventually ended up unifying and running with Benny Gantz. And so they entered this emergency wartime unity government, I think a week or two after October 7th. And now he's essentially not part of Benny Gantz's party. That you see Gideon Saar going on TV and under his name or next to his name, it's his old party running solo. It's not the National Unity Party. sadly enough, there apparently is no longer unity in that party either. So again, what will Benny Gantz's party look like? You have Gideon Saar maybe running alone again. You have Naftali Bennett, the former prime minister, definitely wanting to make a comeback. So Benny Gantz will have more competition from the right. You have someone like the former Mossad director, Yossi Cohen, who's actively trying to promote his brand. It depends whether he runs with an existing party, whether he tries his hand inside of the Likud. Again, we don't know, but he also, I think it's a safe assumption, is planning a political career. You obviously have Yair Lapid to Benny Gantz's left. Yair Golan, former deputy chief of staff of the IDF, a left winger. So he may win the kind of chairmanship of maybe a unified left wing Israeli party with Meretz and Labor and maybe the Kaplan Street anti-judicial coup movement. Again, it'll be all very different. So we have to kind of wait and see how things shake out. But I think it is true, to bring it full circle, that a lot of people are preparing themselves for the potential, the possibility of an election in early 2024. Again, depending on how the war in Gaza goes and depending on what happens in Lebanon and the like. So there may be another election, and Netanyahu knows better than anybody that he's not doing too well, that an election is a huge gamble. And that if and when all the reservists, hundreds of thousands of reservists, are eventually sent back home, again, depending on how the war goes, there will be mass protests on the streets. Mass protests against him, against his government. And it will be, expectation is, it'll be bigger than the anti-judicial coup protests, because now you have even right-wingers and people who didn't take to the streets over the past year against the Netanyahu government, very angry at October 7th and how it was allowed to happen, very angry at the government for its conduct or lack of conduct after October 7th, providing economic and civil support to the people displaced from the south and the north and the victims. So there's a lot of anger, and it's a very visceral anger, because a lot of people are paying and have paid the ultimate price and made the ultimate sacrifice with loved ones who were killed either on October 7th or during the war. And so again, to kind of game out what the public mood may be and how it'll break down according to kind of political party lines. Difficult to say, but it's in the ether. Let's put it that way. Politics is back.
Yep. Politics is back. That'll be the name of this podcast.
If I have to cover an election after covering this war, I will definitely need that beach vacation beforehand.
We'll start a GoFundMe for your beach vacation, Ari, I promise.
There we go.
And we'll send someone to cover your reporting. It'll be great.
There we go. We'll get a nice hotel chain to sponsor this podcast.
Sponsor this podcast. Is Marriott listening?
White Lotus Resorts.
Yeah, we'll start a TV show. Okay, Nari, anything else you want to chat about before we close out? We obviously didn't talk too much about the potential Northern Front to open up, which every time I talk to an Israeli, they say, yeah, hopefully by the time this war ends, another war doesn't start in the north. But, you know, I don't know if there's too many updates on that front. And of course, we're always keeping an eye on the West Bank, especially now more than ever. But really, that's been our MO since we know it's always at risk of kind of igniting at any moment.
Yeah, both hugely concerning, both the West Bank and Lebanon. Stability in the West Bank, as we speak, there's an ongoing operation in Jenin in the northern West Bank that in normal times would be one of the biggest stories in the world. And gotten very little coverage, very little attention, because everyone is focused on Gaza. And so that is a concern. You know, it's a major IDF counter-terror operation in Jenin. You have still 150,000 Palestinian workers who used to work in Israel, drawing a decent paycheck, not able to work now for over 2 months after October 7th. And the Netanyahu cabinet was supposed to approve at least allowing a portion of those workers back. Netanyahu didn't have the votes, apparently, and because of his far-right allies. And so that's a major concern just in terms of, well, the economic and just overall stability in the West Bank. And then you have Lebanon, which... you've seen more strident comments from Israeli officials over the past week that either through diplomacy or through military means, the threat of Hezbollah on the border, literally on the border with northern Israel, will have to be taken care of. And Hezbollah will have to be pushed back because no Israeli that lives up there will return to their homes. And that entire region has been evacuated for the first time ever in Israeli history. And so if you talk to Israelis, and I'm going to be down south near the Gaza border region or in the Gaza border region tomorrow. It's not that people have gone back, but there are people actually living there and farmers, and, you know, there is a semblance of normality. But on the northern border, it's a ghost towns, plural. And those people are not going to come back if they still fear either a cross-border invasion by the Radwan, the elite commando units of Hezbollah, or what you've seen now for 2+ months is, these kind of anti-tank guided missile crews hitting both IDF and civilian targets on the Israeli side. Again, unprecedented in Israeli history. And there are good reasons for restraint on the Israeli side for the moment, not least of which is a major demand by the Americans not to escalate and widen this war, but politically and also just how should we put this politically and also just strategically, it's not sustainable for the Israeli public, for Israeli society, for the Israeli government to have this go on another month, another 2 months, 6 months. So it's a major concern of mine, and it's a major issue here in Israel that, again, just due to Gaza, it gets less attention and less play. So those are two ongoing concerns. And I'll just say, this past week I wrote an article for the Christian Science Monitor, which was an article I'd been meaning to write for a while, basically explaining and describing the mood in Israel since October 7th and then, during the war, and how vastly different it is to how people outside of Israel view everything going on here. It's kind of black and white, you know, alternate realities. And so I tried to do the best that I could in describing how Israelis understand the current situation and the media coverage. You know, essentially it's wall to wall from the moment you wake up till you go to bed at night. It's wall to wall interviews and testimonies from survivors of October 7th or relatives of those killed on October 7th. It's the families and loved ones of the hostages still remaining in Gaza, or now we're seeing, you know, testimonies from hostages that have been released from Gaza. It's wall-to-wall kind of coverage of IDF soldiers who have been killed and their loved ones. Last Friday, there was a funeral that was aired live on all the Israeli TV channels of a 25-year-old reservist in the paratrooper unit who happened to be Gadi Eisenkot's son. Gadi Eisenkot is the former IDF chief of staff. He's now a senior minister in the war cabinet running this war. And it was a very sad thing to watch. All the Israeli leaders were there. Netanyahu, Isaac Herzog, Lapid, Benny Gantz, who spoke. Eisenkot is part of Benny Gantz's party. That unity still remains, unlike Gideon Saar. And so you had kind of Benny Gantz get up there and give a eulogy, and then you had friends of Gal Eisenkot get up there and give a very heart-wrenching eulogy, and Gal's siblings, his brother-in-law. And this was carried live on a Friday afternoon on Israeli television. And so this is the reality that you're watching every day, all day. You know, blow-by-blow accounts of a particular incident on October 7th. Blow-by-blow accounts of the Nova massacre, the festival, the music festival down south. You know, I personally, on my quote-unquote day off this past Saturday, I went to an exhibit in the Tel Aviv fairgrounds, North Tel Aviv, and it was a recreation with the actual tents and the charred cars and the bullet-ridden porta-potties and even the stage and the now somber electronic music of the Nova festival. And you had people, Israelis, buying tickets and going and walking around there on a Saturday afternoon, and with images of the fallen and the kidnapped from the festival, you know, shoes that were left behind, makeup kits, car keys, clothes. And so this is the reality that Israel has been experiencing, and, you know, every Israeli has been experiencing since October 7th. And you can, you know, you contrast that and compare it to, you know, how the rest of the world, or much of the rest of the world, looks on at the war, which is, and again, I'm not giving a moral or, you know, value judgment here, but it's just a reality that to point out the difference, that you have coverage of, you know, dead Palestinians and rubble and destruction, and less of a focus on the trauma and the tragedy of October 7th from the Israeli point of view. So again, just wanted to point that out. And, you know, I think empathy is in very short supply when it comes to this particular war, this particular moment, from all sides. And
sure.
Yeah. And with that,
Mary, you promised me you would end this podcast on a positive note, so that can't be the last thing you say. I'm hoping that you have something for us after talking about the psychological trauma and survivor's guilt about our entire generation of Israelis. So please, let's hear it.
More
something good.
More positive news. I mean, look, we've talked about it before, but you know, to talk about the flip side, you know, if you're not in southern Israel, and if you're not fighting inside Gaza or have loved ones fighting inside Gaza or on the northern border and, you know, in the army or in the reserves, then there is a semblance of normalcy that has returned to at least central Israel. You know, obviously it's not normal. And like I just said a few seconds ago, everyone is still traumatized and re-traumatized every day. But life does go on. And The hope is, and I will end on an optimistic note, Shani, I promise, that the unity and the solidarity and the sense of purpose that this country has now found once again in the tragic, tragic aftermath of October 7th is translated into, say, a more unified and reasonable and moderate and responsible political leadership and government. And so that is my hope. I want to remain optimistic on that note. And yeah, you know, not to bring it all back to politics, but I hope that sense of togetherness is maintained, you know, again, if and when this war ends and we don't revert back to the reality that was existent here on October 6th, which was deep, deep divisions unlike any other this country had known before. So yeah, and I should have maybe more hopeful and optimistic news after I return from my trip down south tomorrow, because I was told that people have returned, that people are you know, farming, working, and the like down in those communities in the so-called Gaza envelope. So next time, Shani, I promise I'll have better news.
I will certainly hold you to that. I hope you have a lovely final two nights of Hanukkah.
Yes, the Festival of Lights, and more importantly, the Festival of Sufganiyot. So that should be the way we end on Sufganiyot. That always puts a smile on my face.
See you, Neri.
Bye, Shani.